I'm a football fan. In fact, a fan of Chicago Bears black and blue football. But it'll be hard to watch football after this week's U.S. Senate testimony that there is what Dr. Robert Cantu of Boston University called growing evidence that repetitive hits to the head of NFL players leads to degenerative brain diseases. Politicians often hear of a problem and call for more protection. I wonder if less wouldn't be wiser. Modern polycarbonate helmets have let players weaponize their heads. Sports highlights usually show elegant passes and nimble runs, but on the line, 350-pound guards and tackles batter each other like rams, play after play, practice and games year after year. The helmets that protect them actually help players block with their heads, which pummels and rattles their brains. Maybe football should replace sleek modern helmets with the simple soft leather toppers they wore in the 1920s, just to keep Red Grange and Jim Thorpe's hair or ears from getting pulled. The threat of old-fashioned pain and dizziness might deter more head injuries than high-tech protection. Now, that could make American football more like rugby, which has plenty of blood, guts, beer, and brass, but no helmets. Padding, for that matter. Rugby players are proudly rowdy and break teeth and bones, but there are apparently few reports of retired ruggers with degenerative brain disease. Rugby is a sport, while U.S. football has become a game of chance in which players can wind up rich and broken. You know what that is. You're listening to NPR News. American schools have struggled to close what's called the minority achievement gap, lower average test scores, grades, and college attendance rates among black and Latino students. Typically, children who are falling behind are placed in remedial classes intended to help them catch up. But some schools are starting to say that the way they group students by ability, often called tracking or leveling, can cause more problems than they solve. Nancy Solomon spent last year as a Spencer Fellow in Education reporting to examine why good suburban schools are failing black students.
The hallways at Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey, are a picture postcard of integration. Columbia is a well-funded school that's roughly 60% black and 40% white. The kids mix easily with a super-friendly vibe. But when the bell rings, students go their separate ways. This is Noel Cooperberg's repeat algebra class, a class of all minority kids who flunked last year. There are only about a dozen students. The school keeps lower-level classes small to try to boost success. But a group of girls sitting in the middle never so much as pick up a pencil and disrupt the class throughout. It's an entirely different scene in Cooperberg's honors-level pre-calculus class, which has three times as many students, and most of them are white. These two classes are pretty typical. Lower-level classes, called levels 2 and 3, are overwhelmingly black, while 4 and 5 are mostly white. Students are assigned to these levels by a combination of grades, test scores, and teacher recommendations.
You could look at the highest achieving kid and the lowest achieving kid and say, oh my God, they're worlds apart, right?
The problem, says Amy Stewart Wells of Columbia University's Teachers College, is how kids in the vast middle are sorted. The racial segregation corresponds to the difference in average test scores between black and white students at the school and nationally. But Stewart Wells says racial stereotypes still play a role.
And what you're seeing in suburbia and how it's playing out along racial lines is testimony to the fact that race still matters quite a bit in the society and very much so in education.
The two towns served by the school are diverse, middle-class suburbs, although a third of the students are low-income and almost all of those kids are black. But a considerable number of the African-American students are middle and upper-middle class.
My name's Hanif Quinn. I was born and raised here. I'm 16 years old. I'm a very intellectual student. I think I'm really actually the smartest underachiever in Columbia High School.
Hanif lives in a large house in a solidly middle-class neighborhood. He has two older siblings who've gone on to college, and he says his parents pushed him to do well. His freshman year, Hanif was placed in level 4 classes, one of a small group of African-American students.
We kind of sat together, be the black kids over here and the white kids over here. It seemed like the teacher, she just stayed on the other side of the room away from us. The teacher focused on the larger group of whites, and left us in the dust.
I've heard that so many times.
Columbia principal Lovey Lilly, who is African-American, is troubled by the racial segregation in leveled classes. She says the levels do reflect differences in skill and work habits, but she believes race plays a part. Lilly conducted research on the experience of black students at her school while studying for her Ph.D.
Black children in higher-level classes were ignored or perceived that they were being ignored, or they did not feel comfortable going to the teacher after school to get help. They gave up and decided to go to level three classes, where at least there were other black children.
But this comfort comes with a penalty. Lower level classes ask less of students, so they do less. The school district's new superintendent, Brian Osborne, who is white, says the lack of rigor in lower levels is his top priority for change.
The second day that I was here as superintendent, I met with a group of middle school students for lunch. And I asked the students, what are your teachers' expectations of you? And the very first thing that one of the students told me was, it depends what level you're in.
The question Osborne has yet to answer is whether lower-level classes can hold students to higher standards, or whether any sorting system sends the wrong message.
Our first day, you know, going to that class, we made a nickname for the class. We called it the retarded class.
Jerry Mournville, a recent graduate, remembers his level two class and how the low expectations affected the way students felt about themselves and about school.
We were mad. A lot of kids, you know, were being rude to the teachers and stuff like that. That class was crazy. It was like every African-American or black ethnic friend I knew in my grade, they were all in that class.
For the past 20 years, proposals to get rid of levels at the school have been defeated by the well-organized parents of highest-performing students, who tend to be affluent and white, and who fear their kids will be slowed down by mixed-ability classes. Teachers are also divided. Richard Moss is an African-American math teacher with 37 years' experience.
I've done both. When you have kids mixed together, then you're going to find that this group of kids at this level cannot work at the same level as someone else, okay? So that it makes it difficult to organize, and then the frustration level increases at both ends.
So we're ready for the choir now. So
on the other side of this issue is Lean Marshall, who teaches a demanding medieval literature class to a mixed group of kids from levels 2, 3, and 4. The class began as a scheduling mistake, but it turned out to work.
Which of you is going to present the squire? Chanel?
Lean Marshall is calling on Chanel Saint, who's been in level two classes since middle school. Yet here he is in Marshall's class, explaining the character of the squire in the Canterbury Tales, and doing it well.
Great, Chanel. A lot of fire.
I saw in the kids who wanted the opportunity a light open up. The kids who had been used to, I guess, doing very basic work, whose English classes, for whatever reason, hadn't been challenging, would come up to me and say, we've just never thought this way before. No one's ever asked us these questions before.
Superintendent Brian Osborne is moving gingerly toward change. He's created a task force to study leveling in Maplewood, and he's hoping to convince parents that education is not a zero-sum game, that the schools can boost the lowest performers while improving achievement for all. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
And tomorrow in the second part of our series, we'll explore how race matters in the education of teenagers. Visit npr.org to see audio slideshows about Columbia High School. The New York City restaurant scene can be fierce, competitive, and bankrupting. But David Chang is doing well. 32 years old, he already has 4 critically acclaimed restaurants, another on the way. Now he's written a cookbook. NPR's David Gura has this profile.
On a weekday at lunch, Mamafuku Noodle Bar in the East Village is packed with people. Customers gathered outside the restaurant before it opened. Now they've crowded around wood tables. They line the bar that borders the open kitchen. Michael Bedrick is from Manhattan. He says he's been to the restaurant once a week, every week, for 2 years.
You have to be somewhat adventurous here, I think, to have the full experience. I don't think you want to just come here and have the ramen. I mean, you should have the ramen, but you should sort of experiment here. I think that's what it's about. It's sort of an alchemy of different things.
It is eclectic. There are pickled cherries and Tokyo turnips. pan-roasted asparagus with miso butter, and Sichuan crawfish with dried red chilies, soy sauce, and scallions. But it's the ramen that made Mama Fuku famous.
There's pieces of pork belly, a poached egg, some crispy pork shoulder, some greens, and a really beautifully done ramen noodle. The texture is lovely. It has a really nice toothiness to it.
Diner Josefa Concannon is from Chicago. The proprietor of this place, the head chef, David Chang, is a bear of a guy with a boyish face. He's Korean-American, he grew up in Virginia just outside of Washington, and he worked hard to get those noodles to taste just right, to get that nice toothiness Concannon liked. Chang traveled to Japan, where he ate a lot of ramen, and he started cooking professionally before it was cool, he says.
All my friends were like, "You're an idiot. What the hell are you doing? Come bank, go bank, be a lawyer, be a doctor, work at this.com. Everyone's working at .com. Now, it's different. It's very strange that you can get recognition because of cooking. I have a hard time dealing with that.
By now, Chang's gotten plenty of recognition, certainly enough to silence his college buddies. James Beard Awards, Michelin stars, and lots of good reviews. He says that his rise to the top of the New York restaurant world was fast, but it wasn't easy. Peter Meehan used to review restaurants for the New York Times. He remembers his first visit to Chang's Noodle Bar, which used to be just up the street in a tiny space in an old fried chicken shop no wider than a one-car garage.
The first time I went there, it was pretty bad. You know, the noodles were overcooked, the ramen was too salty.
It was so bad, he didn't even review it.
And then about 6 months later, I kept hearing from people that this place is great, you gotta go back, you gotta go back. And I went back and you know, I was head over heels about it and went back a few times and wrote a pretty glowing review of it.
Chang got a following and a reputation for his cooking, for his irreverence, and, Meehan says, for his temper.
Korean termites was what they'd call the holes he used to punch in the wall of all the kitchens, you know. There was a point where they had like 20 pictures of Frank Bruni all up over the kitchen walls, but it was basically just to cover holes in the drywall that Dave had punched.
There's still a photo of Frank Bruni, the former restaurant critic for the New York Times, on the wall downstairs. But Chang has settled down. He's learning how to be a better manager, and the walls look pretty solid. But fame has taken its toll on him. His restaurant has grown into a small empire. He travels around the world to conferences, to give speeches, to judge cooking competitions.
I am still burnout, and I had to like look up the term burnout, and it seemed like I had the checklist and everything was there. I was like, I just tired of looking at food, tired of thinking about food, tired of it all, but I still love it, if that makes any sense. And I've been able to work with food, but not on an everyday basis.
We head into the kitchen, which is bustling. He's at home here, no question. The lunch rush is on, and Chang's team of chefs is scrambling to prepare for dinner. Chang grabs a piece of striped bass, some thyme, some garlic, a hunk of butter, and he gets to work. In a couple of minutes, the fish is on a plate with a side of broccoli romanesco. David Chang's food is hard to classify. Is it Japanese? He dismisses that suggestion. Korean? No, it's not that either. It's delicious, he says, and American.
The Dave Chang cop-out on that is pretty good. Sometimes he calls it bad pseudo-fusion cuisine.
Peter Meehan is working with David Chang to, in his words, reclaim the word fusion, to give it new meaning. He's out of the reviewing business, and he and Chang have collaborated on a new cookbook. And in that book, there's the recipe for that famous ramen. And if you decide to make it, clear your calendar. It's time-intensive, and it isn't easy. From broth to bamboo shoots, it takes up almost 20 pages. David Gura, NPR News.
And you can find David Chang's recipe for Fuji apple salad with kimchi and smoked jowl. Whose jowl? On our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Halloween tonight. Our two daughters are going as Simone de Beauvoir and Sheila Bair, chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Well, not really. They're going to be ballet dancer fairy princesses. But 'tis the season to be scary, and the venerable Library of America has just issued a two-volume set, American Fantastic Tales, Terror and the Uncanny, Volume 1 from Poe to the Pulps, Volume 2 from 1940 to now. It's edited by Peter Straub, who's won the Bram Stoker Award and the International Horror Guild Award for a career that includes the novels Ghost Story and The Hellfire Club and several collaborations with Stephen King. Peter Straub joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure, Scott.
What a blinding array of names almost, from Poe to Stephen Crane, Bret Hart. So what moved you to choose a story?
Well, a number of things. I wanted to get a good representation of stories from across the decades, from as early as possible to the present. And so for every generation, I wanted to find people who wrote well in this genre. And otherwise, I was looking for really, really good stories. In some cases, when I got into the pulps, I was looking for very bizarre stories of the sort that only flourished in pulp fiction.
Like
this terrific, absolutely goofy story by a man named David H. Keller called The Jellyfish. It's about a genius mad scientist who brags to his students that he can shrink himself down to the size of an amoeba and does so. And as they watch through the microscope, this posturing, arrogant character is in a drop of water, and he moves inside a thing that looks like a jellyfish, and then he discovers that he can't get out, and he's banging on the skin of the thing.
Oh.
And they see him gradually disappear until he has been totally digested.
Oh.
So, I mean, that's irresistible, really.
I made a note. I loved Melville's story. I'd never read Herman Melville, the Tartarus of Maids.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And if I may, I don't think I've ever read a scarier sentence than this.
Huh.
Two of the girls, dropping their rags, plied each a whetstone up and down the sword blade. My unaccustomed blood curdled at the sharp shriek of the tormented steel.
Oh boy. There we go.
Clearly a master.
Yeah.
Did you spare some authors from being forgotten in this anthology?
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because that's my conviction. Mm-hmm. I had to do a lot of research, and it took about 2 years for me to read through a sufficiency of stories located sometimes very odd places, old pulp magazines, old libraries. And there were people I came across who had been famous at one point. These are mainly women. Mm-hmm. I am speaking of Olivia Howard Dunbar and Alice Brown and Mary Wilkins Freeman.
I read an Emma Frances Dawson I liked.
Yeah, Emma Frances Dawson. I mean,
An Itinerant House.
She only published one book. She was a protege of Ambrose Bierce. She was in the great earthquake of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And after that, she stopped writing. She moved to Palo Alto, and she became a kind of a reclusive piano teacher. So she had not been well known, but these other women had been. And I felt really as though I was kind of disinterring them and giving them a chance to shine again. It was a very satisfying feeling.
Mm. And what's satisfying about horror fiction?
Oh, its appeal to parts of oneself that aren't normally reached. The fact that it opens up a kind of realm of experience which is deeply valuable in itself as a method of learning more and more about life, but which is generally overlooked or ignored. In America, we don't like darkness, really.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an immense quantity to be learned there, and we all experience it in our lives.
Mm. Has the idea of what can frighten us, make us sleepless at night, changed with technology?
Yeah, sure. There are more opportunities now. I mean, you could write a wingding story about cell phones or computers, and I'm sure a lot of people have. There's a great and very strange story by Harlan Ellison in here.
I Have No Mouth?
I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream.
My gosh, what a story this is.
That's an astonishing story. And it's about what Harlan saw as the potential for threat in these massive computers that were just being built at MIT at the time he wrote the story.
And it's breathlessly contemporary now, just mm-hmm. to think that the computers are smaller, but they're
even more
frightening. Before we get to our last question, final sentence that I read in this anthology that I want to share.
Yeah.
You've done a wonderful two-volume anthology, but if the family's going to curl up with a story tonight, anyone you'd like to recommend?
Oh, let me see here. Oh, you know what? There's a very funny, rather grisly story by the great George Sanders
mm-hmm.
called Sea Oak, if their children are teenagers, they might like Stephen Milhauser's Dangerous Laughter, which is about a fad of laughter that gets out of control in a high school in a small town.
Oh, that sounds great. I missed that one. I'll pick it up now.
Yeah.
Peter Straub, editor of the Library of America's two-volume anthology, American Fantastic Tales, Terror and the Uncanny. Mr. Straub, nice talking to you.
Very good. Talk to you, too.
And you can read a review of American Fantastic plus an excerpt from Charles Brockden Brown's creepy story, Some Nebulism, a Fragment, on our website, npr.org. And we're joined now by NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, thanks for being with us. And we asked Mr. Axelrod about that Associated Press report that the number of jobs created or saved by the stimulus bill has been vastly inflated. He said AP was, quote, extrapolating from a small piece of information. We believe we're going to hit our goal, which was to create several million jobs. But the bigger goal is to get the economy growing again. So this week we saw that growth numbers were in a positive direction for the first time since last year. How do you think this issue is going to play out?
Well, on this Halloween, Scott, let me say it's a trick-or-treat, good news, bad news situation. I'd say the good news is this week we heard there's a 3.5% growth in the gross domestic product in the third quarter of the year, which marked an apparent end to the recession. Obviously, it's been the longest recession our nation's seen since World War II. That's good news. The bad news is we have a very high persistent unemployment rate, 9.8% at the moment. And you think about the spending that has been put into the stimulus package. Everyone's aware of the astronomical levels of debt that the government's incurring. So politically, then, it's become a tricky deal because the test of the stimulus now has become one item alone, job creation. And I think that when you what you heard from David Axelrod is saying, wait a second, you've got to look at the fact that the stimulus spending has helped to, I'm quoting from your interview, helped to stem the flow, to stem the momentum of this recession. So he's trying to broaden that picture for the way that voters, especially in New Jersey or Virginia this coming week,
to the polls on Tuesday,
will think about what's going on with stimulus spending. But I'm just back from Colorado, and they're in Governor Ritter's state, 7% unemployment, and they're talking about jobs and the stimulus as having played an important role in keeping the state afloat. Governor Schwarzenegger was at the White House for this announcement on stimulus spending, and he said, coming from California state with 12% unemployment, tremendous help coming from the stimulus.
Yes.
New York Times this morning, though, has an interesting story in which it says that really, people should think about this stimulus package more in terms of teachers. They said that 325,000 of the 640,000 jobs being created or saved, claimed by the White House, only 80,000, 325,000 of those jobs were teachers, only 80,000 in construction. So I think what you're seeing here is a conversation about what is the impact and how will Republicans play it versus how Democrats play it. And the Republicans are saying it's just about jobs, and the White House has not kept their pledge of 8% unemployment or less. And the White House is saying it would have been worse if it not for the spending that's already in place.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.